This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Good morning, everybody. This is Jefferson Smith. I am sitting in for Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program. I am honored to be here. A story Tip O'Neill used to tell. Young woman working in the United States Senate dining room was called over by a man who was sitting down and asked for another pat of butter. And the young woman said, "Sir, I'm sorry, just one pat of butter per customer." The man says, "I'm a United States Senator. I'm asking you for another pat of butter." She said, "Oh, sir, I'm terribly sorry. Just one pat of butter per customer." She says, "Ma'am, I am Chairman of Appropriations. Billions of dollars flow through my fingers. I'm asking you for another pat of butter." "Sir, I'm terribly sorry. Just one pat of butter per customer." "Now, see here, I'm a United States Senator. Presidents quake in my presence. I'm asking you for another pat of butter. Sir, just one per customer." "Now, listen here. I wield tremendous power in this country. I can bring people up on hearings. I can spend federal dollars. I make federal rules, and I make international leaders quake in my presence. Who the heck do you think you are?" "Well, sir, I'm the one with the butter." Now, why do I tell that story? Mostly just because I like it, but also because it reminds us that in democracy, we are supposed to be the ones with the butter. And right now, I think too many Americans are feeling downright butterless. Butterless, I say. On today's show, we'll be trying to torture that analogy further by spreading a bit more butter, by trying to build a movement where we can, in fact, have a democracy. And I say this not for ratings, because that's not ultimately how I'm evaluated. I say this not to be blustery, because bluster for its own sake is boring. I say it because I'm not hearing it said enough. The thing is at stake right now is, in fact, democracy. Today, we are going to be talking about the Trump-NATO. Shout out to Sean for coining it. Trump going after NATO in his visit to Europe. We are going to be talking about asking the question of who is the worst president of all time. And before you think you know the answer, remember that Warren Harding was really, really bad. We are going to be asking the big question on the Supreme Court. And in fact, several questions. Why did Brett Kavanaugh get selected? Why did this president and why does Mitch McConnell think that Brett Kavanaugh should be seated on a lifetime appointment under Article 3 of the United States Constitution on the highest court in the land? And what are grounds for him not to be appointed? And I will argue disturbingly that the answers to those two questions are hauntingly overlapping. That the reasons for Brett Kavanaugh to be selected are also the grounds for him not to be appointed. I had the privilege of joining you on Monday. I made my guess that Kavanaugh would be the pick. And not because I had a great crystal ball. I didn't think Donald Trump was going to be the president. But because I looked at a few factors. One, he's on the Federalist Society list. He was among those that had been vetted to move the court significantly to the right when they did the analysis, one analysis of how to break down judges on where they fall on a political party judicial spectrum. He lands about as far to the right on that spectrum. And every time I say spectrum, I want to remind myself that we not victimize our own brains to think that's how the world should be organized. But he was located on that spectrum in about the same place, just a skosh in from Clarence Thomas. And they would be the two most conservative, the two most right-wing justices on the Supreme Court. And yes, that means to the right of Samuel Alito. That means to the right of Neil Gorsuch. If you didn't know that there was space to the right of them, I would be sympathetic to your confusion. But he would be located there. So one, he had the right judicial politics. Two, I said, well, he had said the right magic words when it came to Roe versus Wade. When he was, because remember, they need all their votes. John McCain is in Arizona. They need all of their votes. Susan Collins is one of their votes. Lisa Murkowski is another one of their votes. To get those votes, Susan Collins already made clear what it takes. What it takes is for the nominee during confirmation hearings and prior, because it's too late, by the way, after confirmation hearings. Article 3 of the Constitution says the only thing that can happen is be impeached. That during the confirmation hearings and prior, the magic words akin to it is settled law that Roe versus Wade is in fact the precedent of the Supreme Court. She made clear, did Susan Collins, that they could not be openly hostile. She didn't say they couldn't be privately hostile, but they couldn't be openly hostile to a woman's right to choose, and specifically to Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey. And we know that Brett Kavanaugh was interviewed, had a confirmation hearing when he was appointed to the D.C. Circuit. And during that confirmation hearing, he said a version of the magic words. If confirmed to the D.C. Circuit, I would follow Roe versus Wade faithfully and fully. It is the law of the land. That last few words are mine. Chuck Schumer questioned him. He said, do you consider Roe versus Wade to be an abomination? Do you consider yourself to be a judicial nominee, like the president said he was going to nominate people in the mold of Scalia and Thomas? Kavanaugh. Senator, on the question of Roe versus Wade, if confirmed to the D.C. Circuit, I would follow Roe versus Wade faithfully and fully. That would be binding precedent on the court. It has been decided by the Supreme Court. Schumer, I asked you your own opinion. Kavanaugh, I am saying if I were confirmed the D.C. Circuit Senator, I would follow it. It's been reaffirmed many times, including in Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Schumer, I understand, but what is your opinion? You're not on the bench yet. You've talked about these issues in the past to other people, I'm sure. Kavanaugh, the Supreme Court has repeatedly, Senator, and I don't think it would be appropriate for me to give a personal view of that case. Schumer, okay, you are not going to answer the question. So he gave a version of the magic words. But third, and so therefore I thought he could get confirmed. Third answer, third reason I thought it would be Kavanaugh is something that we are going to talk about with a guest in about 15 minutes. And that is about a law review article he wrote about the scope of presidential power. Now, when predicting, if you haven't read the article, haven't read articles about that law review article, you might look at Kavanaugh's background to guess, to surmise, to posit what he was likely to opine. And knowing, if you knew, that he worked for Ken Starr and was Ken Starr's attack dog preparing vicious documents to attack President Bill Clinton, including the most salacious details in legal documents and making all arguments that all of these things should be part of an investigation on a sitting president of the United States, not on whether an election had been rigged, not on whether a president was in cahoots with a foreign power, not whether there had been massive billion-dollar scale money laundering, but about whether there'd been a fair and a president had lied about it. And he had been vicious in his attacks. One might think, well, he probably wrote an article to justify how hard he went after Bill Clinton and how presidents have to be held to account and they are not above the law and they need to be investigated if there are grounds for investigation. And if that were your surmise, if that were your posit, if that were your hypothesis, I would probably agree with you. If, in fact, I hadn't known the law review article. And we will talk more about its details, but basically what it says is, spoiler alert, President is above the law. The president's job is so important that they should not be subject to an investigation. And I looked at those three reasons. I said, well, bingo, bingo, bingo. He's going to be able to maintain, he being Donald Trump this time, he's going to be able to maintain the red wall because the Federal Society likes the guy. He's to the right of everybody but Clarence Thomas. Susan Collins might be able to do what she did with Neil Gorsuch and hold her nose and vote yes, or vote yes with enthusiasm, dodging the question of whether she was significantly involved in the overturning of Roe versus Wade because he had said it was settled law. By the way, the reason I say that's not enough at this point is he is not being appointed to the D.C. Circuit. What he said is, this is the law of the land because I work for the Supreme Court. I am under the Supreme Court. I follow Supreme Court precedent. But if you are on the Supreme Court, you only follow Supreme Court precedent if you want to. As was said, all I mean by law is what a judge will do. And he will be a judge in the position of reversing the thing, and therefore his personal opinion now matters more than it did when he was being appointed to D.C. Circuit. And that third one to me was a kicker, because how much would Donald Trump love a Supreme Court, an appointee that he appointed, who is in the room discussing it with other justices, who might be selected to write the opinion, who would at the very least be one of the votes to decide whether this president would be held to account, whether there would in fact be an investigation with full power and full breadth to reach the bottom of this dangerous, disturbing pit. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. I am Jefferson Smith. The call-in number is 202-808-9925. We welcome your phone calls. There's one other thing that I missed, though. And I'm going to talk about that stuff that I missed right after this break. This is the Tom Hartman Show. I'm Jefferson Smith. You're you. We're welcoming your calls. Appreciate you for being here.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The call-in number is 202-808-9925. I'm Jeff. So welcome your calls, and thank you for listening. The question on whether this president will in fact succeed in having his Supreme Court nominee approved, I have grave concerns about. I am concerned that confirmation will be challenging to block, not because I have deep powers of political prognostication, but because I can do basic arithmetic. And I know that it will require every single Democrat, including two anti-abortion Democrats, and it will require, in addition to all of those, at least one Republican who is willing to stand against the entire Republican apparatus, which now includes the President of the United States, the majority of the Supreme Court, a significant majority of state legislatures, a significant majority of American governors. Not, by the way, a majority of the American people. Don't fool yourselves into thinking that somehow we have a small d Democratic government. We have an anti-majoritarian government that lacks legitimacy, and not enough people in the media are saying so. That we have a U.S. Senate that does not comport with the will of people. We have a U.S. House that does not comport with the will of the people. And I don't only mean that in the way that Princeton made clear that the views of regular people are bad predictors of what Congress will do. I mean it in that Republicans keep losing elections, but they keep winning elections because they keep changing the rules. And that if people want a movement of pro-democracy, we need rules that will yield towards democracy. We've got Lionel from West Virginia. Lionel, can you hear me? We lost Lionel. We'll take Louise from Santa Fe, New Mexico. How you doing, Louise? Louise? We'll take Shelley. Can you hear me, Shelley?
Hello?
Hello?
Hey, who's there?
Hello?
Hello?
Am I on air?
Hello?
Somebody is on air. I want to hear from Shelley. Shelley, go ahead.
I have no idea. What's going on?
I think that we might have gotten our calls mixed up.
Louise, can you hear me?
Yeah, I'm Shelley. I'm calling.
Shelley, go ahead.
Oh, I see. Okay. Are you Lionel?
If you're not... I don't... There, Shelley, go ahead.
There's
if your name isn't Shelley, don't talk. If your name is Shelley, talk.
We're on the radio now, not each other.
Yeah, no, I don't understand what's going on.
Oh, they can't hear me at all. All they do...
I don't know.
What
do you want to do?
What I want to say... is that if you think these can be blocked, you have to have an understanding that both Obamacare preservation will motivate Republicans or the two Democrats to stick with the other Democrats, and that Roe v. Wade will convince the Republicans. We're going to be back in just a moment. Thanks. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Jefferson Smith sitting in. Question today, and we'll talk about a few different things. The big question today is, why did Brett Kavanaugh get nominated to serve on the United States Supreme Court? What are the justifications for him to be nominated for the Supreme Court? And what are the rationale to challenge that appointment? And again, spoiler alert, my concern, the insight of the morning, is that the answers to those questions overlap in some disturbing ways. We're going to take Omar. Omar, can you hear me?
Yes, Jeff. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Good to hear your voice. Go ahead.
Good. I really think that Kennedy was pushed out, really, to get a hard line in the Supreme Court, and also to get someone to protect the president, because I think the Mueller investigation is heading to the Supreme Court. And they needed someone. This is all designed by Mitch McConnell to push Kennedy out, get someone who will vote for the president, and get a majority in the Supreme Court.
All right. Now, that was the perfect segue to what I teased before the break. Before the break, I said, well, you know, on Monday, I said I thought it was going to be Kavanaugh. I thought it was going to be Kavanaugh for a few reasons. Because he could get Collins' vote, I think maybe. Because he will maintain the red wall. And because he, as we will talk about in about 8 minutes, he also likes the idea of expansive presidential power, at least when it's wielded by a Republican. But before we go to the next break, I've got to give a shout out to Seth Abramson, who had a thread on Twitter. The Trump-Kennedy Pact. No one is telling the full story of the Trump-Kennedy Pact yet, so I'm going to do so now. You can't understand why Kavanaugh's nomination must be defeated until you understand the dirty deal that got us here. Trump's acceptance of a Federal Society list of acceptable Supreme Court nominees with 20 names on it is what won him the presidency. Don't take my word for it. That is what everyone says about it. That is why, and this is Jeff talking, the red wall stuck together for this person. What no one discussed in the presidential campaign, what neither Trump nor Kennedy ever spoke of, was that the two men, Trump and Kennedy, knew each other. Strange, isn't it? That Trump made the Supreme Court a major campaign issue, but never mentioned to what extent he knew the justice most likely to retire. And Kennedy, yes, was the justice most likely to retire. Everybody knew it. Well, we now know why Trump wouldn't have wanted to mention anything. He wouldn't have wanted Kennedy to mention anything. And incredibly, the answer is, in fact, that Russia. Kennedy's son, and I am quoting, worked for Deutsche Bank, which during the presidential campaign was being investigated for laundering Russian money. The other problem, Kennedy's son was Trump's banker. He worked at Deutsche Bank, loaning Trump lots of money before, probably as Deutsche Bank began to be investigated for laundering Russian money and Russia stood accused of interfering in the U.S. election from June 2016 on. And I continue to quote Seth Abramson. So any reference made by Kennedy or Trump to the fact they knew each other ran the risk of raising the connection at a time Trump was hiding his tax returns. So Trump, who has no filter in public speeches, forewent speaking much about upcoming retirements despite knowing personally the man most likely to retire. And Trump loves talking about who he knows. The added piece to this that I didn't know when I made my prediction, or I didn't mention, was the link between not only Kennedy and Trump, but also the link between Kennedy, Trump, and Kavanaugh. We'll talk more about that after this break. You are listening to The Tom Hartmann Show. I'm Jefferson Smith. We'll be also taking your call.
You're listening to The Tom Hartmann Program. Call 202-808-9925.
You're listening to The Tom Hartmann Program. Call in number 202-808-9925. Hey, team. How you doing? This is Jefferson Smith. It's also the Tom Hartmann Show. Thanks for joining us. Again, when we were discussing this on Monday, prior to the announcement of Brett Kavanaugh to the court, I, during the show, landed on my prediction. I didn't have it prior. I landed on it during the show. And one of the reasons is because I had already been aware of his testimony when he was testifying for confirmation to the D.C. Circuit, and he had used magic words that might be enough to be sheep's clothing to get Susan Collins' vote. Another reason was because, well, he was on the list, and he was the one Ivy League guy on the list. Now the court is entirely again populated by Yale and Harvard graduates. It is the third fact, however, that when I learned, it became really clear to me that he'd be the guy. And I wasn't sure, but I thought. And written the very next day, well, maybe written prior, published the very next day, an article by John Nichols on that third point. I am reading the title. Brett Kavanaugh once argued that a sitting president should be above the law. The author of that article in The Nation is John Nichols. John Nichols joins us now. Mr. Nichols, thank you for joining us, and how are you doing?
Well, I'm glad to be with you, and I don't think we could be talking about a more important topic today. I think that Brett Kavanaugh is the most dangerous nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court in modern history.
Why?
Precisely because of the things that you're talking about here, and precisely because of his background. As an acolyte of Dick Cheney and Karl Rove, a key player in the Bush White House, but also in the Bush v. Gore fight back in 2000 to claim the presidency in that Florida recount struggle. But also because of his writings. I mean, this is a guy who has been explicit in saying that he thinks the Congress of the United States should pass a law that exempts sitting presidents from criminal investigations, prosecutions. I mean, obviously, that's very relevant to Donald Trump and his inner circle at this point. But also someone who, if you read his writings, not just from 2009 in the Minnesota Law Review article, but much more broadly, has an expansive view of the presidency that can only be described as imperial, and that really realizes the great fear of the founders of the American experiment, who indicated that they did not want a president to be a king for 4 years. They didn't want a president who could take office and, at least during his or her tenure, dismiss or disregard the duties and the responsibilities and the accountability of the citizen. Presidents weren't supposed to be so far above us that they could not be held to account. Kavanaugh clearly believes, as I think Donald Trump believes, that presidents should have all sorts of special protections and, frankly, an incredibly expansive view of how they will occupy their offices. So, that's very dangerous as an idea, in my opinion, but even more so it's dangerous if that were to become a central premise on the Supreme Court of the United States.
So before we get to his Law Review article and his talking about presidential power, and importantly, when he's talking about presidential power, he does not extend that to the power of the federal bureaucracy to protect rights other than property rights. He does argue for, in his writings and in his opinions, limited Chevron deference, limited deference to decisions made by the executive branch with respect to regulations. He has written, though, in favor of a broad set of powers for the president as a person, as an elected king. Before we get into the details of that, though, I want to get to the way that you opened, which is that you thought it mattered. Then after that, you said that you gave a little bit of his background. I want to start with that very first principle. Why does it matter that we talk about this? Might sound like a stupid question, but if they've got the votes to confirm, why does it matter that we discuss Kavanaugh, discuss the Supreme Court at this point?
Well, because I think that the system of checks and balances is absolutely essential to the functioning of this republic. I mean, if we allow the system of checks and balances to be undermined, as I think we already have, I think Congress has become largely dysfunctional. I think the courts have become far more activist, conservative judicial activists in recent decades. So we've seen a lot of the diminishing of that system of checks and balances. But if we allow it to be severely undermined, especially in a period where Donald Trump is president, we run the risk of really redefining our sense of how America operates, whether presidents can be checked and balanced when they do wrong. Not merely by Congress, but by the legal process, by lawsuits, by challenges to their executive authority, which we see a lot of, and we historically have seen a lot of.
So I get
their expansive view of what a president can do in times of war.
So I asked a slightly different. I asked a slightly different question. Let me make it a multiple choice. Why is it worth our time to discuss? That is it. A, because the Supreme Court matters generally, and that checks and balances matter generally. Is it B, because this appointment could in fact be blocked? Is it C, because we need a movement to be educated about the importance of courts, because the right wing has been more motivated about in elections, motivated to vote and not to vote based on the selection of courts? Is it D, to influence the draft of history? Is it E, to impact the legitimacy of this Supreme Court, legitimacy of this government, legitimacy of Brett Kavanaugh? Is it F, some combination, or all or none of the above?
Well, of course, it's all or none of the above, or it's all of the above. But let's not do that dodge. I respect your question, so let's focus in on it. I think nomination can be stopped. I believe that from the start. If you don't begin with that basic premise, then we're already so far down the path of diminished and undermined system checks and balances that we ought to be sending up, you know, the red flares and the alarm bells. How can it be blocked? Of course, you hold 49 Democrats in place as opponents of this nomination. That's hard. I understand that there are swing Democrats, but also you reach out to at least one, perhaps two Republicans. And, of course, the thinking on that is Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski. Collins from Maine, Murkowski from Alaska. Now, how do you do that? Do you do that with a traditional campaign of opposing a Supreme Court nominee? Yes, that can be a part of it, of course. All the issues that all sorts of groups want to bring forward are important. Issues of choice, LGBTQ rights, affirmative action, worker rights, environmental protections, defending the administrative state from the assaults that someone like Kavanaugh and other members of this court might advance, voting rights advocates. Of course, all those issues have to be front and center. But if we're to take this that last step, if we're to kind of pull together a coalition that might actually block this nomination, we have to put on top of that, or with that, counsel, not on top of, but literally as a part of that argument, the premise that this guy really is dangerous,
yeah,
right? Not just for all the concerns that you and I have, right? But we might say to someone, even a conservative friend, do you really want this radically expansive view of an unaccountable presidency? And remember, what Kavanaugh has said is deeply troubling, because it's this notion of placing a president above the law. And he knows how troubling it is. In his law review article, as an example, and I know we'll go into it deeper in a moment, but in that article, he acknowledged people are going to be uncomfortable with this. People are going to say, oh, you know, this is putting a president above the law. And he said, no, that's not the case. It just delays accountability,
right,
during the course of a presidency. Well, with all due respect, when you are talking about someone who holds the most powerful position arguably in the world, you're going to delay accountability for 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years?
Yeah, after a decision to stay in or stay or get out of NATO has been made, after the world has decided whether the dollar is going to remain the world's reserve currency, after health care has been decided for millions of Americans, after basic freedoms of women have been decided for ad infinitum, after all the myriad decisions to raid the environment have been made, yeah, I get why justice delayed
and
is justice denied.
Brother, if I could add one final thing on that, after he's pardoned himself and everybody around him.
And let's get to that. So what's interesting, well, so first, to understand who this guy is, and because of the robes, and because of history, and because of even previous courts who felt differently, and because of our education in high school and college, thinking of the Supreme Court as a different branch of government that was less political because of its lifetime appointment, I think we miss that the appointees to the Supreme Court by Republican presidents have been operatives. And there has never been an appointee that I can remember who is more obviously an operative of the right wing than of the political movement. I don't mean merely of an ideological set of jurisprudence. I mean of the political power apparatus that right now governs the country, that Brett Kavanaugh has built his career as an operative of that movement. Say again those quick bullet points on that make it, or disabuse me and the listeners of the notion that I just offered, if you don't think he's an operative.
Of course he's an operative. I mean, it's a given. Look, this is a guy who was involved intimately in the Bush v. Gore recount fight of 2000 as regards to Florida, the contested Florida election. I wrote a book about that fight. If you look at the legal shenanigans, and frankly, the games that were played, but the word game is perhaps an inappropriate term, the really unimaginable interventions that were made by Jeb Bush and his political allies and appointees, by the lawyers that surrounded the Bush team, and ultimately by a majority on the U.S. Supreme Court that shut down an absolutely necessary recount of the votes in the state that would decide the presidential election. I mean, this guy was at the middle. He was the leader of it, mind you. He's a young lawyer, but he was, you know, in the heart of that thing. And you begin with that, right? And then you take the next step. He joined the Bush White House. You can find it. I don't have to describe it myself. Just go, you know, look up the pictures of Kavanaugh and Karl Rove with their arms around one another. Understand that this was a guy walking the hallways and nodding and winking and talking with the likes of Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and George W. Bush at a time when this administration was advancing wild assaults on our civil liberties, when it was promoting the Patriot Act and all sorts of other interventions, but also when we now know they were involved in a massive expansion of government, spying of the national security state.
And he was involved in all of it. We're talking to John Nichols of The Nation. We're going to break in just a moment. So the point here is that, yeah, it still matters to talk about. What John Nichols offers, it matters because it could still be blocked. I offer that needs to be talked about because there needs to be a wider and deeper movement, understanding, and appreciation for a long-term commitment to democracy as it manifests itself with the courts. We've got to care more about the courts. But also, the people, as you're sharing thoughts with friends as we're preaching to the choir and hopefully inspiring the choir to sing, and also hopefully getting some passersby who care about democracy and want to preserve it, the notion that it is he is merely an operative, maybe merely weakens that he is in fact an operative, that he worked to impeach Clinton, that he worked to elect Bush, and also now his views have changed. We're going to stick with John Nichols after this break so that we can talk about that Law Review article at least for a few minutes. John Nichols, stay with us. Listeners, stay with us. I'm Jeff. This is the Tom Hartman Show. Democracy is still sort of a thing, and so we're glad that you're listening.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back to the lab without a mic to grab. Call in number 202-808-9925. We're on Free Speech TV, and Mark, so are you from Fort Worth, Texas. Mark, you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can.
You can? Well,
yes.
Alrighty.
So start talking.
Alrighty then. Well, you know what? I had forgotten that Justice Kennedy's son worked for Trumpy's bank.
Yeah.
But that just completely seals the deal, because what I was going to say is Brett, I can't even remember the guy's last name. It slips my mind. I just turned 60, so I'm having a senior moment here, but anyway, so bear with me. I also used to do stand-up comedy for a while. But anyway, whatever. Brett is just a political hack. He's a political operative. He's a bright guy, Yale and all that. I also happen to have a law degree, just throwing that out there. So I also was in a doctoral program for philosophy. The only reason I'm mentioning that is not to toot my own horn, but just to say, you know, I'm not a dum-dum here. So, but here's the thing. It seems obvious to me that Brett is a political hack, that he's a political operative, that Trump chose him for his positions on what's most relevant to Trump vis-a-vis the Mueller investigation. And this needs to be just hammered home. I mean, he's just not SCOTUS material at all.
Yeah.
This is just an infiltration of SCOTUS by a political hack.
Yep, I hear you. And it is, and thank you very much for your call. I want to hear from Rob in Minnesota, who has a point about Mitch McConnell. Rob, go ahead.
Hi, Jefferson. I don't know really if people out here are as angry about this president as I am. But at the same time, I got a funny feeling a lot of them are. The whole thing is Mitch McConnell, in his own brilliant way, knows that he's going to lose the Senate this fall. So this is the last time that he's going to be able to take and put it to America, and it's going to stay there for a long time. The only possibility that the Democrats have is if they can hold this up till it gets past the election, and if they can, then maybe it's where they can be able to completely shut it down. But at the same time, I don't think that McConnell's going to let it happen, because he wants to put it to America one last time.
It is an important point. I was once in a discussion with a guy who was more politically expert than I was and had been around for a long time. And he said, and I was a young guy, and he said to me that the current politics is trench warfare. And I thought what he meant was that it was nasty, but he meant something more specific than that, that what you do in trench warfare is you try to drive the opponent back so that you can then dig a trench that is closer to where the line was. And you can move your troops there, and you could hold that trench. It's easier to hold a trench than just have people sitting around on the battlefield. And then hopefully you can advance and push further and dig a further trench. And then sometimes the other team, the other army, will wage war against you successfully, wage a skirmish against you successfully, and beat you back from your trench. You'll lose a bunch of troops, and you'll have to retrench your position. That's what retrenchment is. And Mitch McConnell understands that politics in the modern world is trench warfare. And if you have a chance to appoint a Supreme Court justice, it is a trench that lasts a long time. It is a position that is not merely sitting around on the battlefield. It is encamped there. Forgive the war metaphors, but I do believe there is a war on democracy. This is the Tom Hartman Show. I'm Jeff. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Jefferson Smith. On the phone back with us, John Nichols of The Nation wrote the article, Brett Kavanaugh once argued the sitting president should be above the law. We've covered why it matters for us to talk about, both to challenge the nomination and to educate a movement about why courts matter and educate it further. And also because this guy is a Republican operative, not merely a conservative jurist, but a right-wing operative. But now he had an interesting turn. After spending, after making his bones by going after Bill Clinton and trying to limit the Clinton's ability to stop an investigation during his presidency, he then wrote, after working for Bush, he then wrote an article saying, oh, I think that presidents should be above the law, or at least not subject to investigation. John Nichols, what were the basic points of that article, and did it surprise you that he held both positions, both let's go after Clinton and let's not go after presidents anymore?
No, it didn't particularly surprise me. I think that the effort to take down Clinton in the 1990s was a pretty convoluted initiative that began on certain issues and then kind of evolved to others. And a lot of Republican operatives and young Republican lawyers joined into that. And Kavanaugh was a part of it, certainly not the lead of it. His critical formative experience was in the Bush White House. And remember, the Bush White House was a White House that really looked at ways to expand presidential powers. One of the things that people have forgotten about, I'm sure not you and many of your listeners, but a lot of folks have, is that the Bush White House really expanded the notion of so-called signing statements.
Yep.
And that was when a law was passed, the president would sign it. It was popular law. But then the president would attach a letter or a statement that went along with it that said, yeah, you know, this is the law, but, you know, here's how it should be interpreted, i.e., here's what should be done, what shouldn't be done, how we should understand it, et cetera. That's an incredible, you know, overstep by the president saying, yeah, Congress passed this law, and now I'm going to tell you what the law really is as one individual. And again and again, you saw these sorts of abuses of power. They liked doing that, frankly. I mean, they obviously did. But beyond that, they began to formulate a concept of a unitary presidency or of a enlarged presidency. And frankly, Democrats and Republicans have fallen into the trap of thinking, you know, yeah, we ought to give the president a whole bunch of power to really kind of get things done, right? Well, if that becomes our thinking, and particularly if that thinking is supported and sustained by the Supreme Court when these issues come to the court, because ultimately the court's where you're going to resolve differences between Congress and the White House and between our different branches of government, if that becomes, you know, really a driving force idea, a central idea on the Supreme Court, then you have tipped the balance of our entire system against Congress and against, you know, some sort of genuine separation of powers, a genuine checks and balances. Why does that become significant? Well, Kavanaugh himself says, oh, you know, I'm talking about, you know, exempting presidents from, you know, all these legal investigations, stuff like that. But the power of impeachment will still exist. Well, my friend, the more and more we diminish Congress, the more and more we weaken Congress, the less likely Congress does its basic oversight duties. And impeachment is certainly a part of that. But I cannot begin to tell you how dangerous this is to tip that balance so much that the president really is a first among equals.
John Nichols, the article's in The Nation. Brett Kavanaugh once argued the sitting president should be above the law. John, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is the Tom Hartman Show. I'm Jeff.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.